one of the stuff that we saw in Iraq, we called them the Foreign Fighters Network. So those like foreigners, not Iraqis, coming to fight in Iraq. And Abu Mus'ab al-Zarqawi, AMZ, which was the head of, he's actually the guy who is the founder of ISIS. That was a letter that was intercepted. He was sending it to Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden, where he wanted to tell them, like, look how loyal I am, look how this, how that. They thought he was too extreme for them. So when Al-Qaeda thought this guy was too extreme for them, that should raise a lot of flags for us. In addition to that, he was, again, in more than one intercepts from him, where he was talking about, I'm interested in fighters coming from Africa, from Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, Sudan, not fighters coming from the Gulf. And for him, fighters coming from the Gulf, they were coming to get like a ribbon. Hey, I went to Iraq and I fought. So he's like, these guys are not coming to die. I want people who are coming to die. I've seen guys from Libya where they called their families to tell them goodbye and their family were celebrating them, telling them goodbye, but these guys were going to kill themselves.
Welcome to Heroes Behind Headlines. I'm your host, Ralph Pizzullo. Within the U.S. military, there is a unit so secretive that not only is its name classified, but its members are like ghosts to even the U.S. military personnel they work with. Veteran Affairs doesn't even list them. Whether you're familiar with them or not, this highly trained team has been responsible for preventing dozens of terrorist attacks against the United States and Western world. Our guest today was a member of that most highly classified unit in the U.S. military. He calls himself Adam Jamal, but that's not his real name. When he arrived in the United States in the early 90s from his native Egypt, he spoke no English. He came here because he was alarmed about the spreading influence of the Muslim Brotherhood in his country. Because he loved the freedom and diversity the U.S. offered, he enlisted in the U.S. Army. Today, he's going to share the thrilling and inspiring story of how he went from an immigrant to an elite operator in the most secret military unit in the United States and some of the missions he participated in. And he's also going to tell us about his fascinating and enlightening new book that he co-wrote with co-author Kelly Kennedy called The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives. It's my great honor to welcome Adam Jamal and Kelly Kennedy as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines with Ralph Pizzullo.
Kelly, you want to start?
Sure. I'm Kelly Kennedy. I'm an Army vet. I joined, would we figure out, a year, 2 years before you did, Adam?
Yes.
I joined in 1987, served in a storm in Somalia.
Uh-huh.
And then became a journalist after that. And I've covered the military on and off since then and written a couple of books.
Adam, can you talk about growing up in Alexandria, Egypt? What was Alexandria like then?
I was born in the early 70s. And during that time, there was still the war between Egypt and Israel. It was still ongoing. We used to have these brick walls in front of our apartment buildings to make sure there are no shrapnels, none of that. Till 77, 78, we used to sometimes hear sirens. Mm-hmm. A lot of people in Egypt don't remember that anymore. And then in 78, when the peace accord between Egypt and Israel mm-hmm. took place, then they started taking those walls down. It had a lot more of a European, Mediterranean style city, like Roman architects. Than an Arab city.
Yeah.
However, during that time, we had a lot of changes going on. The war in Afghanistan, the original war between Afghanistan and the former Soviet Union was going on. The Egyptian government pushed some of the Muslim Brotherhood and the Islamic jihadists to go to Afghanistan. It's in the movie Charles Bronson's War. It does talk about that a bit. Egypt, Pakistan, Saudi Arabia, with support from the U.S. and the CIA, they were pushing people to fight in Afghanistan. So we used to see those mujahideens coming back to Egypt. Obviously, a lot you had people who saw them as heroes, and you have the other side of the country saw them as terrorists. So we used to see them as extremists since the 70s and the 80s. That's kind of like early childhood, moving up a bit in the time, then moving to the U.S.
When you were a kid, Anwar Sadat was still the leader of the president of Egypt, correct?
Correct. He was the president till I was 10, 11 years old. He got assassinated in 1981.
And then that seems like after that, there was a big change in Egypt and the Muslim Brotherhood gained prominence.
Correct. So after that, the country went into a state of emergency. So they did apply not military laws, but almost like, almost martial laws for a long time. As a matter of fact, they did it for 30 years. And during that time, you could feel it. So as teenagers, we could be walking in the street and some guy in civilian clothes, no identification whatsoever, he can stop you and ask you for your ID.
Oh, wow.
Ask you, where are you going? Where are you coming from? Where are you going to? What are you doing? And you didn't even have the right to ask the guy, who the hell is he?
Yeah.
He's just a guy. He's like, well, I'm the government.
Yeah.
We dealt with that a lot as growing up. So I realized that there was no like rules of law.
Mm-hmm.
So when I was in high school, I remember I told my brother, like, you know, I think I'm going to go spend a year or two in college and leave. And then when I went to college, I was studying law. Law in Egypt is after high school.
Mm-hmm.
And a college professor was like, whatever you guys are studying, most likely you'll never practice.
Huh.
So that's when I was like, well, I really need to leave.
Yeah, and there was a dramatic incident you describe in the book when you're in college and you run for a student council and you're elected and you have a meeting and the Muslim Brotherhood just rushes in.
Correct. Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So those guys from a long time ago, they are a lot more organized than a lot of people think. There are Egypt soccer is like the rest of the world, almost the rest of the world, other than the U.S. soccer is the most common, most watched sports.
Mm-hmm.
So there are two main teams in Egypt. When those two teams play, you find the streets empty, like nothing going on in the street. Everybody just go to watch the game.
Yeah.
So those guys, the Muslim Brotherhood, they planned it. I think that way we had they gave us the room where we can have the meeting as a student body.
Yeah.
They were leading the student body, the student council.
Mm-hmm.
So after I won the election, a group of us wanted to have, we wanted to do trips. We wanted to do things what kids college do. And there is fund from the school,
right,
from the college for those things. They gave us the room. They allowed us to be in that room. Basically, it was during the game.
Mm-hmm.
So the college was empty. We were in the fifth floor. And it was about 15, 20 of us, and literally about 100 of them, 20, 30 minutes into the meeting, 100 of them walk into the room and they kick the hell out of us.
Wow.
And actually one of the guys we had with us, I remember him very well. I remember his name. I remember exactly what he was very, very, very outspoken.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he cursed one of them, like he used profanity.
Yeah.
And literally one of the Muslim Brotherhood said, you know, that guy is Kafir, like he's an infidel.
Yeah.
You guys can kill him. And literally those guys got like chairs and beat the heck out. I really thought they're gonna kill the guy.
Wow.
They almost broke my rib. We went to the hospital to get the right document to file a police report.
Right.
The doctor in the hospital was a Muslim Brotherhood as well. The police officer that in the police station was a Muslim Brotherhood.
Yeah.
So they had it all planned. And then they filed, we filed the police report and they filed the police report. And then at the end, in court, they were like, you, both of you guys gotta, just basically, they mediated and like, you guys just, you have no rights. You have no rights because we didn't know who was beating who. And I was like, if I can beat that guy who's 6'4", 6'5",
yeah,
there is something wrong. But again, there was no rules of law.
Yeah.
And literally after we went to court, I would say, a few months after that, I was in the U.S.
The Muslim Brotherhood is a transnational Sunni Islamist organization founded in Egypt by scholar and schoolteacher Hassam Al-Banna in 1928 on the belief that Islam is not simply a religion, but a way of life. It advocates a move away from secularism and a return to the rules of the Quran as a basis for healthy families, communities, and states. And its self-stated aim is the establishment of a state ruled by Sharia law under a caliphate. Its most famous slogan is, "Islam is the solution." Charity is a major aspect of its work. Over the years, the Brotherhood has grown into the most significant social movement and political opposition in Egypt. After the ouster of former President Hosni Mubarak in the Arab Spring protests of 2011, the group's political arm won a plurality of seats in Egypt's lower house of parliament, and its candidate, Mohamed Morsi, was elected president. But since a 2013 military coup that removed Mohamed Morsi from power, most of the group's leaders have either been imprisoned, killed, or living in exile, or have been forced underground. So, Adam, it must have been very difficult to leave Egypt because, you know, your family's there. Alexandria sounds like a beautiful city on the Mediterranean. It's got all this history. And then at the age, I think you're 20 years old, you come to the United States. And from reading your book, you didn't know anybody here. And you end up in New York City.
I go get a visa to come to the U.S. In the summer of 1991. Initially, it was me and two other guys, and we tried to get a visa to go to Austria, like Vienna. And they said no, because it was during a desert storm. And I don't know why Austria didn't want to give visas to Egyptians. We went tried France. France said the same thing. Then one of the two guys, they were with me. He was the only guy, actually, who had the financial means to travel. He was the only guy who's wealthy enough that he can travel and without borrowing money from anybody. And he said, let's go to the U.S. consulate. I was like, dude, the other two countries didn't give us a visa. You think the U.S. can give us a visa? And he's like, let's just try. And Lord behold, we walked there to give us an application. We fill out the applications. We go next day. I'm not going to bore you with the story. Two of us ended up with a visa. The rich guy ended up with no visa. He's the only guy can afford it. So I borrowed money from my sister. I borrowed $500. Mm-hmm. And my mom lent me money to buy a ticket. And a week after, I was in New York City. Me and the other guy. I didn't speak any English.
Yeah.
I knew how to say, like, you know, what is your name? Where is this address? Stuff like that. But nothing. And I have a booklet.
Right.
As a student, they give you this booklet with all the YMCAs and all that the areas where you'd stay. So I'm like, the YMCA in Alexandria is a very nice place. It's not far from the beach. You can overlook the Mediterranean. Mm-hmm. So I'm going and I'm going to stay in the YMCA, just like the YMCA is on Alexandria. Land in New York. It took us some time to make it to the YMCA. Couldn't get our ways out of the airport to the bus station to the subway to the YMCA, and we finally made it to the YMCA. There are a lot more details in the book, but we finally make it to the YMCA, and I have my $500 hidden in my socks and my shoes. Mm-hmm. There is a bunk bed. Me and the other guy, I think we paid, each one of us paid like $50, so that's 10% of what I have, because I had only $500. And we had a phone number for a guy who went, he was a Boy Scout with me in Egypt. Mm-hmm. But the phone number was missing the one before the area code.
Oh.
So literally for 3-4 hours, I'm trying to call this number and I couldn't.
Yeah.
And it's the YMCA had this common bathroom, community bathroom. Mm-hmm. And there is a guy, I think he was smoking drugs or something, standing there. Finally, he saw me like 6-7 times.
Yeah.
About 2 o'clock in the morning, he just took the number from me. Took the quarter from me, put it there, dialed the number for me, and he's like, here. I don't know if he was sick and tired of me, if he was helping, but he helped me. So finally, I get a hold of my friend, the guy who's with me in the Boy Scouts in Egypt, and I tell him where I'm at. And he's like, don't go to the streets. don't leave your room. Put bunk beds behind your room because they might rob. I mean, the guy like terrified the hell out of me more than I was terrified.
Yeah.
And again, you got to realize that you left everything behind.
Yeah.
And you are a guy who came to the U.S. with a very small suitcase, mm-hmm. and that's your livelihood.
Yeah.
So the people who I see them now, like, you know, come into the U.S. and illegally.
Yeah.
Like, so I'm not like, so people get upset. I'm not supporting illegal immigration, but
right.
the people who come to the U.S. legally, leaving their home,
yeah.
they leave a lot behind. And people don't realize that. You go in as a, like a newborn baby, go into a new country, but you are 20.
Yeah.
So that's how the journey started.
It's amazing. And you talk about how you were making handbags and you were play chess in Times Square for money. You were always a very good, you were like the best chess player in your class and a great athlete and a very good student as well. But then you're here, you have to figure out, well, okay, where do I fit in here? How can I adjust to this new country, this new culture? And in 94, well, you were in New York during the first World Trade Center bombing, which was in 93. Yeah. And that must have been, you know, kind of a scary time for you.
Yeah, of course. So like any immigrant or anybody who leaves from one country to go to another country, you try to find the people who look like you, have the same culture. So what I lived in Jersey City, worked and went to school in New York. So it was just like a 25-minute train ride. And the mosque I went to is where the blind sheikh actually used to go to. And I ran into him there. But when I was there, people were asking him if, like the question people asked him, and that kind of like pushed me even away from this kind of people, where is oral sex forbidden or allowed? And that's like these guys with big brains supposedly sitting down, and that's what they're asking about. So I'm not going to ruin it to the listeners. I wanted to get the book to know what was his opinion of oral sex.
Must have been really weird for you to run into the blind sheik in Jersey City.
Extremely weird, because it's, first of all, that's the guy that were prosecuted in Egypt for killing Sadat.
Yeah.
That's the guy that we used to listen, we used to hear about him a lot in the media.
Yeah.
That's the guy we used to hear how bad he is. And then it gets you thinking, why and how did he end up in the U.S.?
Yeah.
And how he ended up in a mosque in Jersey City, New Jersey. He wasn't doing the sermon, so somebody else was doing, but he used to sit.
Yeah.
And people would go sit around him and ask him questions, like he's a scholar.
Yeah.
So it was extremely weird. And you got to, I sat one time to like, I want to know what these people think about, what they talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the people I ran away from in not just, I don't want to say like I ran away, but those are the guys I really despised in Egypt.
Yeah.
And then here I am in front of that guy. And I'm like, wow, it was surreal for me.
Yeah, that is surreal.
And then with all of these different odd jobs I'm doing, literally I used to work in certain days. I used to wake up at 2 o'clock in the morning, deliver cakes and bread from bakeries to hotels, then 9 o'clock till 5 o'clock working in this latest sportswear store, then from 7 to 9 going to school to learn English.
Wow.
So I tell everybody, like, there are no excuses. If you want to make it, you'll make it. You just got to work hard.
Yeah.
And that's where I talk about, like, that the people, if you work really hard, you're going to find a lot of people who are willing to help you.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm working in this latest sportswear store. The owner, his name, he called himself Jim.
Mm-hmm.
His real name was not Jim. He's Israeli Jewish from Iraqi descent.
Mm-hmm.
And first, when I started working for him, the first like week, he didn't tell me where he was from.
Mm-hmm.
And then after a week, I was like, hey, Jim, you have an accent. Where are you from? And he's like, I'm your cousin. And I'm like, that's really cool. So I thought he was Jewish. He's like, I'm your cousin and I'm from Israel. This is the two opposite. Here's a kid from Egypt, Muslim, Arab kid from Egypt, working with a Jewish Israeli guy.
Yeah.
Immigrated from Israel. But we both had one common goal, which we both immigrated to the U.S. We both wanted to make the best out of our lives.
Mm-hmm.
And that guy was phenomenal. He's one of the best guys I worked for.
Mm-hmm.
So he and I sitting down one day in the store, and we hear the news about the World Trade Center.
Wow.
The first World Trade Center.
Yeah, yeah.
And at that time, I mean, right after the first Gulf War, by the way, Arabs in the U.S. heard all kind of names. And I like I said, We have people who would like to put their head in the sand and say, no, 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 we'll never say these things. We're very welcoming. And
yeah,
there is certain level of racism. I mean, we got called like, you know, camel jockeys and
yeah,
sand niggers. And we got called a lot of names. So when 93 happened, I was like, okay, this is going to make it even worse for people who look like me. So we everybody discovered it was actually the blind chief was behind it. And there was some other group behind it. And they were trying to, basically where they took that truck, they were trying to put the truck with the explosives between the two towers to make the two towers collapse against each other.
Yep.
So that was their intent.
Yeah.
So that didn't work out. Yeah. Then I think a year after, it was the Oklahoma City bombing. And I was like, again, I was still working with Jim still.
Yeah.
And I was like, okay, please God, don't make this another Muslim extremist.
Right, right.
And then it was Timothy McVeigh.
Yeah.
And then nobody blamed the entire Christian race or the entire the Christian religion or the white race.
Right.
But when the guys did this in 93, we were all blamed.
Yeah.
Then a year after, a few months after, I signed up to join the military.
Mm-hmm.
I was still in college, so they put me in the deferred, it's called deferred entry program. So they you sign up, and then they let you finish your semester in college, and then you ship to basic training.
Uh-huh. And so you joined the Army, the regular Army, correct?
Correct. That's the best branch in service.
Mm-hmm.
So all the Marines and the Air Force and the Navy guys, no, we are the best branch.
But please buy our book.
We can cut that part out if you want. And then you're in the U.S. military. Your team sergeant's calling you a camel jockey. How weird is that, right? And it sounded like he wasn't a bad guy. He was just like ignorant. He didn't even really know that it was a pejorative term or...
Honestly, absolutely. He was not. He was not a bad guy at all.
Yeah.
He was a young sergeant, young E5.
Yeah.
He was in Desert Storm. So I guess that's what they call people in Desert Storm. So he came back. He had that in his mind. The guy was not trying to offend me.
Yeah.
I wasn't offended because I didn't understand what a camel jockey is.
Yeah.
Tell somebody, pulled both of us aside.
Yeah.
But we stayed friends. I stayed friends with that guy. He deployed with me to Bosnia for 9 months.
Mm-hmm.
We stayed in tents for 6 months where he was with me in the same tent.
Mm-hmm.
For 6 months. We used to play cards. I mean, like again, he did not have any bad bone in his body. He was just saying those things because he thought it was funny.
So you go to Bosnia, and that must have been a really interesting experience for somebody with your background, because there's another war that's going on in Bosnia and Serbia, partly over a religious division.
Correct. That's what I tell people too. So it was basically... the Serbians were fighting the Bosnians. The Bosnians are Muslims. The Serbians were like, part of the stuff I saw there was, it was clear, part of it was like clear, almost genocide. They used to take some of them, put them in a big warehouse. I was assigned to a military police unit. So we would go with people who were investigating war crimes as well.
Mm-hmm.
So we went to this big warehouse where there was a lot of blood in the wall. You see blood, like high in a certain level. Then you see like a low.
Yeah.
So you can tell it's somebody who's a child. You see, so the blood from the head.
Yeah.
And then the UN guys who were doing this, they had some sort of cotton swabs, like cotton balls.
Yeah.
Or like Q-tips.
Yeah.
You put it in a liquid and they put the liquid on the wall. And if it turns certain color, then that's brain cells. So that somebody was shot in the head.
Yeah.
So we would go and see this. So basically, they had people standing in line and they were shooting them in the head.
Oh my God.
In some sort of a warehouse. That's one of the experiences that I saw. And then at the same time, you see these guys who are being killed for being Muslims.
Yeah.
But when you talk to them about Islam, they had no idea. They thought Ramadan was 3 months. Ramadan is only 1 month.
Right.
They really had no idea. They were born Muslims.
So culturally, they're Muslim.
Exactly. So it's more of a culture thing. It's most likely Islam entered there like 700-800 years ago during the Ottoman Empire.
Right.
And then it never left. And these guys were like, oh, you get born. When you are born, you're like, okay, you're Muslim. You're Christian. You're Jewish. It's just whatever label you were given. But they didn't know anything. But they were being killed
right
for that. And at the same time, I'm going out with this military police unit. I see all of these different things. And you see the kids, like, you know, running behind the Humvees, wanted MREs, and they just wanted, like, you know, some chocolate, some M&Ms.
Yeah.
Then you see, like, you see kids, you see, and you start thinking, like, you know, why are we killing each other? And as an army guy, everybody think you shouldn't be thinking that. And I'm like,
right.
We're not ignorant. We're not stupid. The U.S. military pride itself by being the most educated military in the world. We don't say we are the strongest or we have the best weapon.
Right.
We say we are the most educated military in the world.
Right.
So as a population of veterans or military guys, we are educated enough to be able to differentiate between extremists and non-extremists. Mm-hmm. We're able to understand and listen and have a conversation and analyze information. Mm-hmm. So that's one of the things that as us in the military, we should still like have that open mind when we're having these discussions.
Absolutely. Because as you point out in the book, in a lot of these situations, soldiers are put in really a peacekeeping role, especially in Bosnia, where you're trying to keep the two sides from killing one another. You're not there to fight. You're there to be policemen more.
Correct. And if you don't understand why they are fighting, if you don't understand the culture, if you don't understand, because you can easily offend somebody and start another war.
Right.
So that's what I'm trying to push in the book is like, we really, Sun Tzu in the Chinese philosopher general in the Art of War,
mm-hmm.
His first rule is know yourself and know your enemy.
Yeah.
And if we don't know the enemy because we're not willing to know the culture or the language, or we're not willing to understand what they think, well, we are doomed to fail. And if you ask anybody, like, I would love for somebody to show me, like, the last war that we won, like, clearly won
yeah.
since World War II.
Yeah.
The every war after that, it was, we go, we stay a lot of time, we create a lot of damage, and we leave. But did we achieve our goals?
Right. And as you point out, we go into other cultures where we don't really understand a lot of times the language. We don't understand the history. We don't understand the culture. And so a lot of times the soldiers who were sent there, it's hard for them to even understand why they're there. And then it takes them months and years to be able to relate to the people. Kelly, I'm sure you encountered that in your deployments and in Iraq and so on.
Yeah, unfortunately, when Adam tells the stories about the things soldiers said in Desert Storm, and that was my crowd, right? And
yeah,
we didn't know anything. So hearing him talk about his experiences and his knowledge going into these places, it just strikes me as what we should have known. I mean, we went into Desert Storm not even knowing that it got cold there, and we all got cold.
After deployments to Bosnia and Kosovo, Adam was asked to take a temporary assignment at FBI headquarters in New York. They needed Arabic speakers who could translate sensitive documents, including an Al-Qaeda training manual that was mostly ripped off from U.S. Army training manuals, down to the graphs and pictures, with lots of radical Islamic propaganda and some made-up scripture from the Quran thrown in. Adam moved to New York and walked to FBI headquarters in Federal Plaza, past the same deli in Lower Manhattan where he had worked 5 years earlier. It was only 3 weeks after his new Egyptian-born wife had arrived in the United States. You go to FBI headquarters in New York, and they need Arabic speakers. But you find out that all the Arabic speakers that they have are basically Christians, and also that there's just sort of no sense of urgency about trying to understand what's going on in the Muslim world, what's going on with Al-Qaeda, who are now, you know, they've attacked our embassies in Kenya and Tanzania. Can you talk about that atmosphere and how you felt about it?
So it's very interesting, too, because people don't like it. People want it to always be politically correct. But if we were telling the truth and if we were thinking about it clearly
yeah.
before 9/11, maybe we would have prevented 9/11.
Sure.
So when I went there, there was like 11. They used to have at that time 11 native Arabic speakers
mm-hmm.
who were working for the FBI. So one of them was Muslim. Not all of them were Christian. So there was one Muslim.
Okay.
The Muslim guy, his name was Ben Vaughn. So I'm like, hey, Ben, Ben Von is not an Arabic name.
Yeah.
It's not definitely not a Muslim Arabic name.
Right.
So I talked to him one day and I was like, hey, man, how did you get this name? And this is a true story. And I hope people don't get offended from this, but this is a true story.
Yeah.
So the guy goes and he's like, hey, I was applying for jobs with my real name. And I kept applying for jobs. The guy, I think he was Palestinian American.
Uh-huh.
Came to the U.S. in a young age, no accent whatsoever in English. He spoke fluent English. So English and Arabic, both of them were his first language.
Yeah.
So the guy is the guy that you would want it in your team. I mean, he knew the language inside out.
Yeah.
So he told me that when he was interviewing for jobs, he wouldn't get hired because of his real name.
Mm-hmm.
And his real name was a pure Arabic name.
Yeah.
He's like, so I changed my name to Ben Von.
Yeah.
And I applied for the FBI, and lo and behold, I got hired.
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, wow, that's really interesting. So I'm not saying the FBI as a system was against Muslims, but the people who they hired in the beginning, they wanted it to, we feel comfortable with people who look like us and think like us.
Sure.
The guy who was doing the exams was an older, he was in his 70s, an Egyptian American Christian.
Mm-hmm.
It was funny, I've seen it firsthand where he made people fail because they were not what image he has in his head.
Right.
And poor FBI people didn't know, the actual agents or the agent in charge. They didn't know that guy's doing that.
Right.
So it takes this is the diversity I'm talking about.
That
bring people who are qualified, but with diversity.
Right.
After 9/11, years after that, I met a coincidence. I met a lady who was working in HR in the FBI when 9/11 happened.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me she knew the director of the FBI was going to ask her after 9/11, how many Muslim agents do we have?
Yeah.
And if I remember correctly, she told me there was one or two in the entire FBI.
Wow.
When I went to the FBI in New York, I worked on translation for the USS Cole bombing attacks.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on Al-Qaeda manual that they had for a few years. And literally, I've seen guys working in the FBI at that time, linguists, native linguists, working there, translating the Quran. And I'm like, I can buy you one for $20 in English already. You don't have. And he's like, no, no, no. So those are the things that we were really.
Yeah.
Just we were so relaxed. We were far away from everybody, and we thought, you know what, nothing would happen. And by the way, if people go and read the 9/11, they had the. The report, they had the investigation
the
after
commission
the
9/11
mm-hmm. commission.
Mm-hmm.
If they read it, they will see a lot of the things I'm talking about is there. So I'm not attacking the FBI. I'm not attacking people. I'm not attacking anybody. I'm just stating facts.
Yeah.
Those are facts that things were happening that we missed out.
Yeah, it was the same at the CIA. I've spoken to people and written books about that. And they had a very few native Muslims and people who were good translators. And I remember talking to one guy and he said, well, at 9/11, they had taped all this stuff, but there was a 9-month backlog to translate it. So, you know, what good is that if you're getting intelligence, you can't even tell which intelligence to act on and how urgent it is.
That's why we call it timely intelligence. If it's not timely. So if I know a day after the attack happened, an attack was going to happen.
Yeah.
Well, you're a day late and a dollar short.
Right. And you're picking up the pieces. Yeah. So after 9/11, everything changes. Suddenly, they're starting to take more of an interest in somebody like yourself with your background and your language skills. And you end up being recruited into special forces or special operations. I don't know what you want to call it. And you go into more training. And you talk about when Daniel Pearl, the journalist for the Wall Street Journal, was captured in Pakistan and beheaded, and how that sort of changed the mentality for special operators.
Yeah, absolutely. So I was recruited before 9/11. I didn't go till after 9/11. So I was recruited initially about 3-4 months before 9/11. I was in Fort Bragg, Fort Liberty now. So I wasn't planning on going. I was like, let me just finish a couple of things. And then 9/11 happened, and that expedited even my decision to go. And then part of our training, I don't want to, without saying anything classified, part of the training is how do you deal if you are held, if you are taken a hostage? So it's like fear training, survival, evasion, rescue and something, and escape. It's like fear training, but ours is a bit specialized.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not, so we do fear and we do something else. But again, part of the training is if you are taken as a hostage, how do you deal with it? And initially it was, you deal with it with, like, you know, you build rapport, you build relationship, you do all of these things.
Yeah.
Well, after that, the Daniel Pearl happened, they didn't give the guy like, hey, let's build rapport and let's talk to you and let's interrogate you. They just beheaded the guy.
Yeah.
Then after that, it was like, okay, if you get captured, initially it was like, don't try to escape, because in the attempt of escaping, you might get killed.
Right.
Well, we knew if we were going to get captured, we were going to get killed.
Yeah.
So might as well, as soon as you get captured, you try to escape. You do everything possible to try to escape. For me, it was double whammy, because for me, I'm not just a U.S. soldier. I'm a U.S. soldier who's Muslim. So for the other side, if they captured me, it was going to be a party more than if they captured somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, I had to be a lot more careful. So I was balancing between some of my teammates without me knowing, or without me, some of them, and it's clear, just clear after a few years after that, some of them didn't consider me as a teammate.
Mm-hmm.
And I've seen, like, I've heard comments. I'm keeping this positive, and I'm not, like, saying anything about those things.
Yeah.
But again, I knew, like, you know, I'm a guy who had to balance between, like, okay, if I get captured, how's it gonna be? If I'm in a bind, and then they come in to rescue somebody, they're looking for a U.S. soldier who's most likely a JSOC guy.
Yeah.
So they're looking for the 90%+ white males over 6 foot tall.
Yeah.
I'm none of those. So I was like, well, if anything happened, how is this going to end up for me?
Yeah.
So yes, so the training change, in addition to the training changing, my mindset.
Yeah.
Personally was different.
Yeah. And then you deploy to Iraq in 2003. And you find that the military is booting out talented people because of their sexual orientation and other factors. And you're looking at this and just going, you know, what the hell are we doing?
I was an operator. I was a JSOC operator.
Yeah.
Deploying, we start hearing, like, you know, people from DLI being with that. And I gotta be honest here. Some people didn't want to go to war.
Yeah.
So they went and they said they are homosexual get out of going to war.
Okay.
In addition to, there are some people got kicked out because they were homosexuals.
Right.
So the sexual orientation, because we were still under the don't ask, don't tell policy.
Yeah.
And again, for the record, when I was stationed in Fort Bragg, so Fort Bragg falls, 82nd Airborne Division, it does fall under the 18th Airborne Corps,
mm-hmm.
and the 101st Air Assault Airborne Division as well in Fort Campbell falls under the 18th Airborne Corps. I wanted to say it was 1999 or 2000. Where a soldier in Fort Campbell, I don't know if he told his teammates, if his teammates found out, anyway, something happened where they found out the guy, he was homosexual.
Yeah.
They threw him out of the third floor. They killed him.
Wow.
So at that time, the 82nd Airborne Division commander, two-star general, they took a week and they talked to every soldier assigned to the division.
Mm-hmm.
And they were like, we not going to tolerate somebody attacking somebody, killing anybody. And it was like the policy at that time, it was the fastest way to get yourself out of the army if you didn't want to stay in the army, to go and say I'm homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was like almost like a 5-day turnaround from the time you say I'm homosexual to the time they kick you out.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I think Kel and I did our research and we looked at how many, when I was writing the book, I wanted to know how many got kicked out of the military in the span of like that period of time.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't remember the number correctly, but it was a large number.
Yeah.
And again, in the book, I'm highlighting, like, guys, we're going to war.
Yeah.
And I always believed if somebody is capable enough, fit enough, patriot enough,
mm-hmm.
want to go die for his country,
mm-hmm.
who am I to say, no, you can't?
Right.
To me, I believe to each its own. So if you know what, you wanna wake up in the morning and you want to pray to the east, I want to pray to the west.
Yeah.
That's why America is better than anywhere else.
That's right.
So that's during that deployment where I've heard those things. And at the same time, I saw people, civilians, who I would trust them with my life. I trusted them with my life.
Right.
Well, we also highlighted the number of people who were pushed out who were interpreters, like very essential, mission essential people who, because they were gay, were pushed out of the military. It was like thousands. It was obscene.
Yeah.
So Adam having
said 11,000 people. 11,
yeah. yeah. So Adam having to work as a, I mean, he'd go in and translate the interpreters because they just weren't always very good because we lost many during that time.
Yeah.
The civilian contractors used to cost us most likely at least 4 or 5 times what a military guy would cost us. That's one thing. The second thing, a military guy who puts the uniform on and gets treated as a uniformed service member, he joined the military because he's willing, knowing that he can die for his country. An interpreter that you hired as a contractor is going to make as much money as he can to leave. And I'm not saying they're all the same way.
Yeah.
I'm not criticizing them by no means. I'm just saying we had the opportunity that guys we trained and we spent a lot of money on them to teach them the language.
Mm-hmm.
And they were good in the language that we trained them on. And we were like, we don't like the way how your face looks. People might criticize me saying like, you know, I'm a guy who's talking about racism, but guys, don't fool yourself. We did have racism in the military. We had sexism in the military. When I was in the 82nd Airborne Division, the company I was in didn't have any females. It was Bravo mm-hmm. company. I'm not going to say what unit, but they used to call it Bravo Balls because it was all males.
Yeah.
We did not have one female.
JSOC stands for Joint Special Operations Command. Its Tier 1 special mission units are the cream of the crop in the U.S. special operations community and are the first ones to get the call in time of crisis. JSOC regularly changes the names of these units and keeps other details secret for operational security, meaning that information about them is often outdated by the time it reaches the public. Some of the units included in JSOC are the Army's dedicated counterterrorism, hostage rescue, and direct action special missions unit, Delta Force, which conducted the raid that killed ISIS leader Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi in 2019. Another is the Naval Special Warfare Development Group, DEVGRU, formerly known as SEAL Team 6, most famous for Operation Neptune Spear, the raid that killed Al-Qaeda leader Osama bin Laden, and the Air Force's 24th Special Tactics Squadron, which is made up of combat controllers, pararescue men, special reconnaissance operators, and tactical air control party commandos. And then you talk about how Abu Ghraib happened, which was just this horrible situation that was many mistakes were made, and we don't have to get into that, but how it sort of changed the dynamic for U.S. troops like yourself and you, Kelly, serving in Iraq, and how suddenly this became, Abu Ghraib became like just a recruiting tool for Al-Qaeda.
Absolutely. Before Abu Ghraib happened, I used to go out of the base. Me and my people from my team, we would go out, we would go buy shawarma, we were going buying like carpet shopping, and we had people who would go buy carpets. And literally our first year in Iraq from like March of 2003 till I wanted to say March of 2004.
Yeah.
We felt we can move around with a lot of freedom of movement. People were still welcoming us. People felt that we're there to free them from tyranny,
yeah.
Which we did. But at the same time, there was a lot of mistakes happening, not in the background. There was a lot of mistakes happening. We didn't train people the right way how to deal with the culture. I went out in most likely more than 100 hits. In the middle of the night, I was going out with like guys from Delta.
Mm-hmm.
And we would go out in hits looking for Saddam Hussein. During the day, sometimes we went to restaurants to detain guys from terrorist organizations. So we were going to all of these different places. And you can see our lack of understanding of the culture slowly was turning them against us. So in the beginning, we went to a house. And I swear, the guy, the owner of the house, we went to that house at 2 o'clock in the morning, blew up the door of the house. We went in, and once the guy realized what we were doing, once we realized that he's, you know, somebody told us Saddam is there.
Yeah.
And once all of this was, you know, everything calmed down, the guy was insistent in offering us tea. He's like, please, just stay. He was being hospitable.
Yeah.
He was being so nice.
Yeah.
That didn't last for long, and it lasted for a year. And then after that,
yeah,
Abu Ghraib was again, one of the best recruiting videos for Al-Qaeda, because they went and they said, look at what they're doing to your men and women. Mm-hmm. They are raping them. They are doing this. They are doing this. And justice went on. So we gave Al-Qaeda a gift at that time.
Yeah.
And again, we had at that time over 100,000 soldiers. If we say the guys who did this were 10, let's say we're 1,000.
Yeah.
So that's 1%.
Right.
So 100,000 suffered for the actions of 1%.
Yeah. Awful stain on our reputation. Absolutely. And then you talked about how everybody was looking for Saddam Hussein and doing it in a particular ways. And once again, not really understanding the culture or how to get around and talk to people. And just sort of use logic to figure out, like, okay, where is this guy? And instead, you were driving around in like a beat up yellow car and talking to cafe owners and just hanging out and saying, hey, what have you guys heard?
Yes, absolutely. So I was doing a lot more than talking to cafe owners, but we cannot, the other side is classified, so we cannot talk about that.
Yeah.
But going around, talking to people, hearing what people saying, trying to understand, even in interrogations, trying to understand how tribal Iraq is.
Yeah.
So all of those leaders at the end, when they really, really get stuck, they go back to their tribe.
Yeah.
It's happening now. It happened now in Syria.
Yeah.
With Bashar al-Assad, his supporters are, again, his tribe, his people, his own people.
Yeah.
So it wasn't, I wasn't a genius to figure out, like, Saddam Hussein was going to be in Tikrit, mm-hmm. where the entire family was at, where his cousins and uncles and nephews and his the people who were extremely loyal to him, mm-hmm. because he showed them the best time of their life. Then when we went to Tikrit, palaces everywhere. There was a house we stayed next to. We called it the pool house. It was an entire big house just with a swimming pool.
Uh-huh.
So this was in a big, and this is not a compound. This is like almost a small town.
Wow.
Was built for the Saddam's loyalists, and
yeah,
had a house there, his family. So it wasn't hard to figure out that he would be integrated.
Mm-hmm.
But again, you have to understand how those people think. You have to,
yeah.
Again, I cannot overemphasize the culture understanding. And I used to say this when I was in the military. I said, guys, it's not just the language understanding.
Yeah.
It's the culture.
Sure.
Because there are a lot of like nuances in the culture. I can tell you something and it might seem like as a joke when you hear it and you understand every word I said, but it's not a joke, or vice versa.
And you talk about in your book about how after seeing what was going on in Iraq and the buildup with Al-Qaeda and the radicalization of Muslims who were coming into Iraq, you started to realize that the problem was that a lot of the recruits were coming from Africa. And you wanted to shift your attention to stopping that and going to Africa, which at that point we were sort of not paying any attention to at all. We only had, I think you said, 4 people.
Yes. Yeah, so one of the stuff that we saw in Iraq, we called them the Foreign Fighters Network.
Mm-hmm.
So those like foreigners, not Iraqis, coming to fight in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
And Abu Musab al-Zarqawi, AMZ, which was the head of, he's actually the guy who is the founder of ISIS, what's known as ISIS now. That was a letter that was intercepted. He was sending it to Ayman al-Zawahiri and bin Laden,
mm-hmm.
where actually he wanted to like to tell them, like, look how loyal I am, look how this, how that. And they thought he was too extreme for them. Mm-hmm. So when Al-Qaeda thought this guy was too extreme for them, that should raise a lot of flags for us.
Yeah.
In addition to that, he was, again, in more than one intercepts about him or from him, where he was talking about, I'm interested in fighters coming from Africa.
Yeah.
From Egypt, Libya, Tunisia, Morocco, Algeria, Sudan, not fighters coming from the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And for him, and that's what he stated in a couple of things, that fighters coming from the Gulf, they were coming to get like a ribbon.
Yeah.
Hey, I went to Iraq and I fought.
Yeah.
So he's like, these guys are not coming to die. I want people who are coming to die.
Mm-hmm.
I've seen guys from Libya where they called their families to tell them goodbye, and their family were celebrating them, telling them goodbye.
Wow.
But these guys were going to kill themselves.
Yeah.
And the target at that time too, like Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was targeting more Iraqi Shia. Then, and he's like, you know, you kill Iraqi Shia and then you kill Americans and Brits, it's a bonus.
Yeah.
So we saw the flood of fighters coming from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where, and for the longest, I was like, we really have to look at what's happening, not in this region, but what's happening in the other side.
Yeah.
And then the unit, that was a decision way above my pay grade at that time. But it was like from the JSOC command where they decided to send people to Africa.
Okay.
And then we started going there. So they sent four people in the beginning, and then these four people after a couple of years were like over 100.
Mm. Adam, you talk about how while you're sort of keeping tabs or trying to track these people who are being recruited in Africa, you notice that they have a literature, which is basically sort of propaganda for the radical arm of Islam, which is not really what the Quran is about. And that you notice that all of this literature is coming from Saudi Arabia.
So it's not just literatures in Africa.
Yeah.
I've seen it literatures from a lot of places. Those like from the Wahhabi Saudis.
Yeah.
They had the money. They had the extremist mindset. So I used to see a lot of, even in Egypt, and you grow a bit older and you start thinking more and you get better education and you start analyzing what you read. And then you start looking at where the book was published.
Yeah.
And then every book was terrifying the heck out of people about Islam was like published in Saudi.
Yeah.
So there wasn't, it was, let's publish books that are going to tell you like when you die, you're going to go to the seventh hell underground if you don't listen to us.
Yeah.
If you don't listen to your leader, you're going to hell. If you salute the flag, you're going to hell.
Yeah.
If you sing the national anthem, you're going to hell.
Yeah.
And you're like, what am I going to do? What can I do without going to hell?
Yeah.
So you start thinking, and then, yeah, I start seeing a lot of literature from Saudi Arabia, and hopefully that changed now with the current regime. I know it did change with the current regime because the current Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia really, really took extreme measures to get those people they are almost out of the equation now.
Yeah.
They trying to be more tolerant, but they still have a lot of work to do because this was since 1920.
Yeah.
So for over 100 years, you have people feeding you this kind of Wahhabi Islam.
Yeah.
And nobody was paying a lot of attention to that.
Mm-hmm.
Again, possibly because, you know what, Saudi Arabia has a lot of money. They are allies. I mean, you can name a million reasons. I don't know what's that. But we should have paid a lot more attention.
Yeah.
But you could see mosques in Africa. You could see mosques in Bosnia. As a matter of fact, you see some in the U.S.
Yeah.
Now it's not as much as it used to be. But Saudi Arabia would give you like a lot of literature and help you build a mosque and give you an imam too if you want it.
Yeah.
So they had a way of reaching out. The government of Saudi, I know their intention was not to export radical Islam, but the Wahhab is there.
Yeah.
They were exporting radical Islam.
Right. And we should point out that this is not the Islam that you grew up with or that 90% or more than 90% of Muslims grew up with. This isn't really the Islam in the Quran. This is sort of a really narrow kind of extreme interpretation, just using certain verses and so on. But a lot of these people that they bring into these madrasas are not educated, and so, you know, they don't know the difference.
Correct. And if we don't allow like dialogues, if we don't open our minds and we don't allow dialogues to go back and forth, we're going to keep hating each other.
Yeah.
Because they think of us, they think of America in a certain way. Some of them will tell you like America is morally corrupt.
Mm-hmm.
And in America, we'll go and say, this is our armpit of the world. And
yeah,
the Middle East is this and Islam is this. So unless we have these open dialogues, we're going to keep doing what we're doing.
Yeah, yeah.
So I was hoping the book will shed some light on, guys, we need to talk more. You cannot go with the policy of, if you are not with me, you are against me.
Right.
I could disagree with you,
yeah,
and still be with you, and vice versa.
Yeah.
So I'm hoping that the book will get that point across clearly.
I think it does.
I'm sure,
yeah.
Kelly, when she was working with me,
yeah. Yeah,
she felt that. But that's that, again, for us to reach a better life for all of us,
mm-hmm,
we need to open the doors to those dialogues. And even not just relate to one another, even challenge one another respectfully. But if I've never read the Bible and I want to challenge you in something, or I want to tell you something, but I've never read it, but somebody told me, you know, I've seen it on Facebook that all brown short guys are evil.
Yeah.
And then people see, and then they see somebody and like, well, he's evil. I'm like, how do you know he's evil? Well, I've seen them on Facebook.
Right.
Well, why didn't you have a conversation with that person to see if he's evil or not?
Right.
So as a civilized, as the richest country, the most civilized country, the most educated country in the world, I hope that we can actually lead the world into those dialogues and those understanding. Mm-hmm. The military, the army, is the first. It was one of the first organizations in the U.S. government that they canceled the segregation.
Yeah.
So I joined an organization that welcomed diversity. Mm-hmm. And again, we're talking about diversity in every aspect of the diversity, including the skill sets, the languages, the look, the everything.
Right.
And we didn't lower the standard.
Yeah.
To say, well, you know, we got to give quotas to this.
Right.
No, again, that's why I joined the army. That's what motivated me.
Right.
To join the army. Like, there is a system there that should protect people who look like me.
Let's just talk a little bit just about being injured in Africa. I think you were in Somalia. Can you talk about that? Sort of the, you know, without giving away anything, just kind of the work you were doing there and how it led to you being injured.
So we were tracking Al-Qaeda East Africa guys, mm-hmm. and they were in Somalia. The operations was in Somalia. We were not based in Somalia. We were based somewhere else in a neighboring country. Mm-hmm. We used to go in and out of Somalia. And one time we almost get ambushed and we had to run for our lives. And it was six of us, two from my organization, two from the Navy SEALs, and two civilians, other government agencies. I think mm-hmm. we put it in the book. So hopefully people want to know which government agency they can read the book. But when we left, it was clear that they were coming to attack us.
Yeah.
We had intercepts after that. They were attacking us. The locals that we were working with, they got attacked right after we left. Mm-hmm. They got in a firefight. They lost some of the guys. The funny story that nobody seems to believe is like, one of the guys got shot, I think, and his eyeball like went out. And literally, like a week after, they took like a cow eyeball or something. They put something just to fill the gap. They didn't make the guy see.
Yeah.
They didn't do a surgery to make the guy see. They just put something there.
Wow.
To block it, rather than putting like a patch. That's what they did.
Yeah.
But that night when we came back to our base country, at night I was going back home and I was ambushed.
Yeah.
There was three people waiting by my house. One of them shot me as soon as I came out of the car. And then initially I didn't think I got shot. I didn't feel anything. Mm-hmm. I felt like a very small pinch. Like I was like, maybe it's a ricochet. Mm-hmm. After we got into this fist fight and the other two guys came, they got the guy off my hand. I put my hand in my stomach and I felt like, hot liquid.
Yeah.
And this is when I knew I was shot. It was dark, so I couldn't see it.
Yeah.
My teammate was inside the house, knocked on the door. He opened. I asked him to call the embassy. The embassy was supposed to send somebody with an ambulance. It took, I don't know, like, took an hour. I was passing out. I can't tell anybody, like, what was I tracking time. And people tell you, like, when I get shot, this is what I will do. I'm like, guys, nobody knows what you will do when you get shot.
Right.
Hopefully you never get shot.
Yeah, yeah.
But it took some time. Then I found one of the guards in the compound where we were living. He had a pickup truck, and I said, you taking me to the hospital? Mm-hmm. He took me to the hospital, and I think that guy hit, like, every pothole in the city. The city was full of potholes. And you didn't know how much your core area means and how much your guts mean to you until you see it like wobbling inside.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And when I finally made it to the hospital, by the time I made it to the hospital, I think I was bleeding for like about 2 hours.
Wow. And you could feel yourself getting weaker, right?
You feel yourself getting weaker.
Yeah.
You think in the entire time, okay, I got to stay alive.
Yeah.
I have a wife, young wife, and a newborn daughter. My daughter was not even... she was not 4 years old yet. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking all of these things. My dad had passed away like about 7-8 months before. Mm. So all of these things, I think, like, I start believing, like, you know, you believe in the positive thinking brings, attract positive things.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was like, you know, I just cannot die. And I'm not, I was refusing to die.
Right.
Made it to the hospital. This is a hospital in East Africa that felt like everything was broken, including the x-ray machine. So they had to sit me up to do an x-ray. And as soon as the nurse set me up, I felt my guts came out of me, literally.
Wow.
Then I asked her, I said, hey, looking at the entry wound and the exit wound, what do you think that it hit?
Yeah.
She's like, 99% your kidney. And I was like, well, thank God I have two of those. I'm not going to tell your listeners if I lost my kidney or not.
Yeah.
They can read it in the book. But what right. I what they know is I didn't die.
Yeah.
So because I'm talking to you.
Well, we're glad about that. We're very glad. Without giving anything away, let's just talk a little bit of tribute to the unit that you work for, because clearly you're very, very highly trained technical unit. But at the same time, as you just described, you're kind of out on your own, very operational as well, lots of danger. And you talk about some of the amazing kind of people that you served with. Some of it just sounds unbelievable. Guys able to pick up languages in a couple of months and so on and so forth. Can you talk about that for a minute, Adam?
Absolutely. So we were very technically and tactically trained. So all our guys were extremely physically fit. Guys and girls,
mm-hmm.
Extremely physically fit. The organization provided us with anything we needed, honestly. It was like, and they were, I remember the first commander I worked for, he said, to whom too much is given. So he's like, we're giving you a lot, but we're expecting a lot from you.
Mm-hmm.
So if we had somebody who's like, you know what, I have the aptitude and I have the interest to learn Arabic. So we had a first speaker. Again, this guy is native Hispanic Americans. So he grew up speaking English and Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
Learned Farsi, was fluent in Farsi,
hmm.
and then he decided with the war and with the GWAT and then after 9/11, he's like, I'm going to learn Arabic. So he once learned Arabic in 4 months.
Wow.
So I was like, you know what? Bullshit. There is no way he could know Arabic that good in 4 months.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm like, we sit down and we talk, and we're listening to, like, let's say we're watching a TV, and I'm like, hey, what did they say?
Yeah.
And he's like, they said this and this and this.
Yeah.
And then we pause, then we fast forward, then we go fast. And I was like, dude, you are scary smart that I don't know, like, what's in your head. Like, really smart.
Yeah.
We had another guy that I didn't mention in the book, and it's my mistake that I couldn't. But this is a funny story. So I have, where we were at, they had a language school. This is in the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
They had a language school where we send guys to the language school.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a guy who spoke Arabic well. And again, he learned Somali like in 4 or 5 months.
Wow.
And we sent him to take dialect classes. So Arabic is like, we have like 7, 8, 9 different dialects.
Yeah.
Moroccan, Algerian Arabic is the hardest. Then it goes easier. You have the Levant, you have the Gulf, you have Yemeni. So we send this guy to learn Yemeni Arabic.
Mm-hmm.
And the teacher, it happened that I knew the teacher was a female. It happened that I knew her husband.
Mm-hmm.
So she talked. So her husband talking to me. They don't know I'm in the same organization as this guy. But they're telling me there is a guy, and they told me his name. And they said, we don't know if he's military or civilian, but he speaks Yemeni just like us. And I was like, what's his name again? They told me his name. So I didn't say anything.
Yeah.
Next day I went to work. The guy used to work for me. I pulled him aside. I said, hey, man, let me tell you what I just heard about you. We had a Marine. He was really good in languages as well, tattoos everywhere. So when he would walk to a class, everybody was like, this guy is like shaved head, tattoos, neck tattoo, sleeve tattoo.
Yeah.
Like every tattoo you can think of. So everybody will think that guy cannot be good in the language. They think, well, this guy's just a killer. He just knows how to kick doors.
Right.
Which he did.
Yeah.
He knew how to kick doors. He knew how to do this. And again, I've heard from his teachers how polite he is, how professional he is, how sweet of a person he is.
Mm-hmm.
So we had guys who just from all ends of the spectrum.
Yeah.
And again, that's what made us very unique. We had females who they would easily beat the heck out of a male.
Yeah.
We had females who are physically like a cross-country skier. We had females who want to learn languages on their own.
Yeah.
So all of those things, that's what made the unit a very unique place. And again, we are tactically and technically capable. So it's more of it's a mix of special operation as well as intelligence collection.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of guys who were Ranger qualified, Green Berets. There was a Ranger that worked with me in a deployment, mm-hmm. and he knew how to, like, he's like a network engineer kind of guy. Like, he's like, let me just connect this, let me do this. And I'm like, how did you learn all of these things? He's like, in my own. So yeah, the guys were extremely capable and they humbled the heck out of me.
That is heartening to know that there are, you know, all of these capable people in our military, including, you know, yourself, Adam, who are protecting us and have so many skills and also, you know, language skills, cultural skills. This is a great thing and can be a, you know, kind of an example to the rest of the country. You know, it's such a rich country in terms of the people, individual people with all kinds of skills that come from all kinds of backgrounds. And we all come here to kind of, you know, make a better life for everybody. Can you just talk to wrap this up about you made a decision to, you know, to leave and you have a retirement party and you did a couple, like, you know, really unique and beautiful things. First of all, your daughter and your wife, so many people showed up. They were kind of like, it seems like confused, like, you know, how do you know all these people? And I guess they didn't really know what you were doing before. And then you took your, you wrote them both letters, you framed it, and you attached a bronze star. Can you talk about why you did that and what that retirement was like for you?
Of course. So a couple of things. Both of my daughters missed a lot of their birthdays and exams. I actually missed my wife getting her, I missed the ceremony of her U.S. citizenship.
Mm.
Which is a big deal.
Yeah. I mean,
it's a huge deal.
Sure.
A lot of people don't realize that it's a huge deal.
Sure.
She went on her own because I wasn't available.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of people didn't know the amount of like sacrifice that guys in the military do, especially guys and girls in the special operation community.
Mm-hmm.
But during my retirement ceremony, I did not know this many people would come either.
Yeah.
So I was surprised myself.
Mm-hmm.
I had a supervisor, I had a boss, colonel. He was about like 6'2", 6'3". He was really tall. So in the ceremony, it was really funny. I'm 5'1".
Mm-hmm.
He's like a foot taller than me. Really nice guy. So he did a really good job too. Is like, you know, making sure that the word is out.
Mm-hmm.
So I had people throughout my career. Even people were stationed with me in Germany.
Wow.
Which was in '97. They attended my retirement ceremony in 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And I made it in the 1st of April to just tell people, like, so people would think like it's April Fool's Day that I'm not retiring, but I fooled them when I retired.
Mm-hmm.
My brother came, who came from Pennsylvania. He lives in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
My wife and two kids, they were actually, and then my wife used to work for the State Department, so they were in an overseas assignment. So they came from overseas for that as well. And then about like 400 people showed up. So there was not enough seats. So I didn't know
mm-hmm.
that many people will show up.
Mm-hmm.
It was extremely like heartfelt for me, like, you know, all of these people come in, that meant a lot to me.
Mm-hmm.
Two of the most senior intelligence officers in the U.S. Army were there.
Wow.
My brother came and he found all of these bios. So in our ceremony, we put our bio in the chair. So when people say they can read about what a great guy you are, like if they didn't know you. So my brother looks and all the chairs have only my bio. He thought this is like one of those common military retirements
uh-huh.
where they have 5-6 people retiring.
Yeah.
That's why we have all this. And he's like, what's up with your bios and all of this?
Yeah.
Who else is retiring? I was like, this is just me.
Yeah.
When they were folding the flag, which it was flown over Camp David,
mm-hmm.
I have a buddy of mine who's sitting next to my brother. And he's like, dude, your brother was eyeballing. He was crying. And I was like, dude, I did not look at anybody.
Yeah.
I was very careful and not to look at my wife because I know she was about to cry.
Yeah.
And my daughters were the same. But let me tell you about the Bronze Stars and the Purple Heart.
Mm-hmm.
So I took the actual medals that I received,
mm-hmm.
not medals that I bought.
Yeah.
Those are the actual medals
right.
that I received.
Right.
I took them and I put them in a frame. I did one for my daughter, my younger daughter, that it happened during a deployment was when she was still young.
Mm-hmm.
She was born a few months before that.
Mm-hmm.
And my younger daughter, my older daughter, again, for a deployment that from early on in my time in the unit, because she was born early in that year.
Mm-hmm.
And then for my wife, I gave her the Purple Heart because I did believe if it wasn't for her, I would have not stayed alive. And she dealt with a lot of my shit.
Yeah.
When I came back, she tells me, like, I used to wake up sometimes in the middle of the night and kick her mm-hmm. or, like, punch.
Wow.
I didn't know I was doing that, and I yeah. still don't know
yeah.
did that. I still tell her I wasn't doing that.
Yeah.
But that's what a lot of people don't realize, like, you know, that we have work to do for our veterans, and we should keep pushing.
Absolutely.
To take care of them.
Absolutely. Well, Adam, it's a beautiful story. It is a story of the American dream. You know, thank you so much for sharing it for the book with Kelly. Kelly, you did a wonderful job, and thanks for your service, and, you know, God bless, man. What a great story.
It took over a year.
Yeah.
To get the approval, some other cool stories we wanted to put there, they took out.
Sure.
Rightly so. We didn't want to put the people in missions now.
Of course.
In harm's way. So
yeah.
Please read the book, and you'll be hopefully pleasantly surprised.
And inspired, for sure. In the end, Adam's story is about the continuing vitality and promise of the American dream. It's about how a 5'1" Muslim man became a Tier 1 special operator in the most secretive unit of the U.S. military. And it's about how, without his brown skin, Muslim upbringing, and cultural understanding, he would never have benefited our country to the extent he has. Adam wants two groups in particular to hear his story. Military leadership, so they understand the need for diversity, and Muslim Americans, or immigrants from any place on the planet for that matter, because he wants them to know that there's a place for them here, a place that's ready for them and desperately needs them, a place that took him in and gave him dignity, respect, and the freedom to open his mind and fully be himself. I thank Adam for sharing his insightful an inspiring story, and for his and Kelly Kennedy's excellent book, The Unit, My Life Fighting Terrorists as One of America's Most Secret Military Operatives. It's my great honor to name Adam Jamal and Kelly Kennedy as today's Heroes Behind the Headlines.
Heroes Behind Headlines. Executive producer Ralph Pizzullo. Produced and engineered by Mike Dawson. Music provided by Extreme Music. For exclusive content, please join our Patreon group at patreon.com/heroesbehindheadlines.